To call the meeting of the Capital Investment Committee for March 13th, 2018 to order. And we don't have quorum as of yet, so we won't do the minutes. We'll just move right on to the presentation. What we have today are overviews. We have a presentation by the Minnesota Historical Society, a presentation by Glenn Sheen Mansion, and a presentation by Second Harvest Heartland. And so we'll begin today with a presentation by the Minnesota Historical Society. Gentlemen, welcome to the Capital Investment Committee.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stephen Elliott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present the Minnesota Historical Society's top priority for the 2018 capital budget, Historic Fort Snelling. My remarks are going to be relatively brief. I'll provide an overview, but then we have four supporting testifiers who will also speak briefly to the project. Thank you also, Mr. Chair and members, for taking the time to tour Fort Snelling on your capital budget visits last fall. It's extremely helpful to see this important place in person, to appreciate both the historic landscape and structures where so much of our state's early history happened, and the significant facility needs at this historic site. This is a place where two major rivers meet, the Dote, where people have gathered for millennia, where cultures have met for generations, and it is the home of Minnesota's oldest building and residence. A few quick reminders from your tour. Our vision for the site is to create a destination for discovery, learning, healing, and a place of community connection, and to engage visitors in a much broader range of history stories, beginning much earlier and extending the story of the fort and the hundreds of thousands who served there into the mid-20th century. Funding for this site will create a new visitor center and preserve historic structures. We will develop programs that will engage visitors in the many stories that have happened at this place. Mr. Chair, you had a brief opportunity to visit the current underground visitor center. Here are a few images of the chronic water penetration and serious and costly maintenance challenges of that building. We are very appreciative of funding provided in the 2017 capital budget bill for design for this project. We've recently completed schematic design for this project, and we're excited to share some of the early ideas. Visitor services will be located in two historic structures, buildings 18 and 22, and we will improve the visual connection to the river. These floor plans give you a sense of the visitor functions that will go into buildings 22 and 18. Building 22 is an 1878 munitions building. It will welcome visitors and provide orientation to the area as a whole, and it will provide much-needed space for school groups. Building 18 is a 1904 cavalry barracks. It will serve as the visitor center. It includes 4,500 square feet of exhibit space on the first floor, more than doubling the exhibit space we currently have. And on the second floor, we will have much more space to accommodate school groups, programs, and meetings. Now, this is really important because on some days we are maxed out in terms of the number of school visits we can accommodate. And as teachers will tell you when they're planning a trip to Fort Snelling, when they come, they want to make sure they can be inside with their kids for lunch in case it's pouring cats and dogs outside. The state of Minnesota has made commitments for this project through appropriations for pre-design and for design. Our request this year is for construction. Typically, the state has responsibility for historic sites in the statutorily designated historic sites network. In this case, we know that Fort Snelling is very important to many, many Minnesotans, and we have committed to raising funds to supplement the appropriation that we hope the state will provide. Construction of Fort Snelling began in the fall of 1820. We're approaching a bicentennial, not a centennial or a sesquicentennial. We're approaching a bicentennial of Minnesota's first National Historic Landmark. We ask that you approve this construction appropriation this session to keep the Fort Snelling project on track for the fort's 200th birthday. Now, we are also requesting funds for asset preservation for the state's other 25 historic sites. There are more than 150 structures on these sites, and nearly half of them are over a century old. It's imperative to maintain these structures and their systems to keep routine fixes from becoming major problems. Now, to cap off this overview, I'd like to share with you a 90-second video that we've prepared that introduces the project to folks who are interested.
Before Minnesota became Minnesota, there was a place, a confluence of two great rivers, where cultures and civilizations crossed for thousands of years, where something new was imagined, a remote American outpost built, a place of pride and sorrow.
It's a place of rebirth and birth, but it's also a place of great tragedy.
Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first national historic landmark. In 2020, Fort Snelling will be 200 years old. In time for its bicentennial, we have a new, expanded vision for this site, where visitors connect with each other, with the many stories that bind us together, with the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. Our plan includes a new visitor center to replace inadequate and aging facilities, places for private reflection and public remembrance, a reimagined visitor experience sharing more complete stories of the diverse people who shaped our state and country.
Did you find it surprising that we did actually have slaves here at Fort Snelling?
Stories of the many soldiers who prepared here to fight for America. Soldiers who are buried nearby. With new investment, historic Fort Snelling will attract more of the millions who pass through this busy corridor every year by sharing an American story told nowhere else. With its bicentennial on the horizon, help us realize the potential of this unique place and position historic Fort Snelling for the next century and beyond.
And with that, Mr. Chair, I would introduce to you Rick Nash, Lana Hunter, Annette Atkins, and Karen Lucas, who will speak briefly to the project. Rick?
At this time, we do have a quorum. And Representative Stock, have you perused the minutes? Are you able to move their approval?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move approval of the minutes of...
That would be March 7th.
March 7th. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes have passed again. Our CLA, Jennifer, has cookies here for us today. Bonding cookies. They've got dollar bill signs on each of them. I thought... Rick Nash is going to be with you? No, that's not Rick. I know what Rick Nash looks like. That's not. All right, welcome to the committee. As you address the committee, please introduce yourself and then continue.
Ladies first.
My name is Karen Tanaka Lucas. I'm with the Twin Cities Japanese American Citizens League. My family has been an American one for well over a century, and I have been a Minnesotan for almost 50 years. My dad was a U.S. military soldier who retired at the rank of major after 20 years of service to our country. He was in the first class of mostly Japanese American soldiers who intensively trained in 1942 with the then top secret Military Intelligence Service Language School in Camp Savage, Savage, Minnesota. This was part of the first ever military language intelligence program in the United States and was housed in Minnesota during World War II because of the receptiveness of then Governor Harold Stassen and the people of the state of Minnesota. It was moved to Fort Snelling when it outgrew the rudimentary Camp Savage facilities and ended up training 6,000 Japanese-American soldiers in language intelligence for World War II and the post-war occupation of Japan. My dad served in the South Pacific interrogating captured prisoners of war, even as his whole family was incarcerated along with 120,000 other Japanese-Americans over 3 years in what were then called internment camps. The military intelligence soldiers trained at Fort Snelling have been credited with shortening the war in the Pacific by as much as 2 years. After the war, my dad served 8 years in the occupation of Japan, along with other Fort Snelling-trained linguists, in the disarming of the Japanese military, the war crimes trials, and in counterintelligence work. We appreciate the Minnesota Historical Society and Historical Fort Snelling, who have been working with us over the last couple of years, presenting programs highlighting the unique role of Minnesota in American history. Visitors come from all over the country, and our guest books reflect that they come from all over the world. And we find that these facilities have been suboptimal in presenting these important exhibits. The Twin Cities chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League asks for your support and funding for the revitalization of telling the history of Minnesota and historical Fort Snelling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Erdahl, committee members, my name is Annette Atkins. I'm a professor emerita of history from St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict, and I'm involved in the private fundraising effort for Fort Snelling through the Minnesota Historical Society. Fort Snelling stands at the meeting point of those two great rivers and at the meeting point of so many of Minnesota's stories, so much of our history, and so many visitors. It is one of the most visited sites in Minnesota, so it's one of the places that's most important for telling Minnesota's history. For 50 years, historic Fort Snelling has offered a history of 1820s America and pre-Minnesota, a story of soldiers on the frontier. The Historical Society's plan for revitalizing historic Fort Snelling will continue to tell that history and will add layers of other history that also overlap with the fort. Native Americans have a history at that site from at least the time of Cahokia and the Mound Builders through the present. So do Japanese Americans. So do Civil War and World War veterans and their descendants, including Albert Lee. So do British and French and American nations, and one of my favorite historic actors, Giacomo Beltrami, a sort of an Italian explorer who was looking for the headwaters of the Mississippi in the 1820s under a big red umbrella, pulling his canoe along rivers and creeks because he didn't know that you're not supposed to put yourself in the front and your gear in the back. So do slave men and women and those freed slaves who came here and founded Pilgrim Baptist Church in St. Paul. So do immigrants Mary and James Hill and John Ireland and Hans Mattson and Ole Rovag and pioneers, including my own ancestors, the Langlands, who settled in Jackson County. So did early missionaries, fur traders, entrepreneurs, tricksters, and a few fraudsters, not including but named the Godfreys, the Norths, and the Steeles. We still visit the Ard Godfrey House in Minneapolis. Northfield is named after these Norths, and the Steeles at one time owned the property that Fort Snelling is currently on. Henry Sibley and Jean Faribault and their native wives and their mixed-blood children also have stories there. So does my friend Stephen Nelson, whose mother worked there as a nanny. So does Walter Mondale, who mustered through the fort when he joined the Army. The Minnesota Historical Society aims to tell this story of and to reveal to us and to the citizens of the state, the many layers of history that we have there that make up our story. Minnesota deserves this deep, penetrating history of our state. So as a scholar, as a teacher, long time of Minnesota history and of American history, I also ask for your support for revitalizing Fort Snelling and giving us the place that Minnesota deserves to tell its story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Erdahl, Hamataki Api, Lana Hunter, Maki Api, Sisitawan, Ke Wakbetawan, and Mataha. My name is Lana Hunter, and I'm from the Sisitawan or Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate Nation in South Dakota. I live here in Minnesota in St. Paul and have for the last 20 years. My ancestors come from this area, from Minnesota, and I am honored to be part of our Dakota Community Council, which is part of the Minnesota Historical Society for over a year. We have upwards of 40, I would say, consistent members that come from all over Dakota communities, including Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Canada. And we come from all of those locations because we were relocated there in 1863. And so many of us have come back to this location and joined in partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society to talk about what narratives can be and should be included at this sacred homelands. And so we talk about this bicentennial coming up for 200 years. And so for us, you know, that 200 years is just a small portion of what this Dakota homeland and this sacred site has meant to our people. And so not only do we want to tell the story of the imprisonment of our Dakota women, children, elders, we also want to tell the story of this Dakota homeland, this site that these two rivers, these confluents come together. And that is what we want to highlight in the landscaping that we've been able to be part of with the Historical Society in the buildings and the telling of how we tell that story with that beautiful land, with everything that is revitalized, and how do we do that in a way that honors all of our Dakota relatives, but also tells the story, as my colleague here shared, about our those who were enslaved there, as well as our Civil War veterans, as well as our Japanese Americans who were interned at that camp. I am the granddaughter of Winfield Thompson, who was a Bataan Death March survivor. He was a prisoner of war for 3.5 years. He fought out of the Red Bull Division, 194th, out of Brainerd, Minnesota. So I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much for your time, and I ask for your support for this important investment and to tell the story of all Minnesotans. Hamataki Api.
Thank you. General Nash.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's great to see you again. I spoke to some of you last week with regards to this project, and I appreciate the opportunity to make some comments this afternoon. I'm here as a volunteer board member of the Minnesota Historical Society and just recently been asked to sit on its executive committee. Formerly, I was the Minnesota Adjutant General. I was a commissioner for the Department of Military Affairs until the end of October. And so I would ask your support of this very good project.
Just for fun, why don't you give them your name?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Nash, Major General Retired Rick Nash. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. This project certainly will go a long ways in continuing from the initial days of Minnesota, the Minnesota Guard, to continue on what we do for supporting our service members and our veterans, as well as what the testimony's already been with regards to Japanese American, African Americans we need not also forget about, and for the slaves that many do not know in Minnesota also resided at the old Fort Snelling. But the history of Fort Snelling continues on to this day when we have sailors, Marine Corps, the Air Force Reserves, and the National Guard are residing on the property that adjoins Fort Snelling, and it's very historic to all of them. We use it to train our soldiers, to train our staffs about our history. And so it provides that opportunity very close to our locations, and a new visitor center, in my estimation, is paramount. I was in the construction business for over 32 years in my dual life, and there's two types of underground facilities, those that leak and those that will leak. And this one, committee members, is leaking, and it's not a proper place to showcase the entryway into Minnesota. It's a central gathering point. It's an entryway, and that's where it first started in Minnesota in 1820. So I would ask that we take a look at that visitor center very hard and repurpose the historical buildings that are there. We're not talking about new bronze and granite and glass. We're talking about repurposing. And I think it's good money well spent to repurpose historical buildings for a new facility for our visitors coming to the state to learn about our history. The Anglo-Saxons, the African-Americans, the Japanese-Americans, the Native Americans, stories need to be told. And, Mr. Chairman, as an author, I know you may appreciate this analogy, but Fort Snelling probably was our first edition book that was written about the history of Minnesota. And within those covers, I think we need to continue to write our history, to document it, to research it, to interpret it, and then to publish what we have. And it's a gateway for Minnesota that all visitors should be able to see in a respectful place for our history. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I do have Fort Snelling in two of my books, but I'm not offering any commercials today. Any questions of the testifiers from the members? Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that when we viewed it, we saw a concept of the general area that's of import. Do I remember correctly that some of this project, as it's matured, will also extend down to the buildings where the police pulled us over? If you weren't there, you have no context for that. But it's
yeah.
You gotta get to the mic. Sorry.
So I'm not certain exactly where you intersected with the police, sir. But the work site for this project extends from the old fort up the river to where the one surviving mule barn still is. And that area will be reconfigured and re-landscaped there. It does not extend to work on what is called the upper post.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, then, thank you. I believe we have another gentleman had a comment, Mr. Jerry Kaiser. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I am the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. And yesterday we were here for the Veterans Day on the Hill, and I was privileged to be involved with that whole organization. And we handed out this itinerary of our initiatives that we want to have done in the state of Minnesota. It includes the United Veterans Council, which you have 30 organizations. The County Veterans Service Officers, there's 87 counties. And also the Commander's Task Force, that's another 9 large organizations, talking about the VFW, the American Legion, the DAV, Vietnam Veterans of America, the Marine Corps League, AMVETS, and I believe if I'm missing one, the Purple Heart and Marine Corps League. All those organizations, which would include about 500,000 people, which would be their families and all those members, we all wholeheartedly endorse this. It's our last one on our sheet here, and it's important you know that all the veterans organizations that we know of support this 100%. Many of these men and women who went in the service, depending on their age, went through Fort Snelling. On a personal note, my father, who was a farm kid from North Dakota, in 1942 he was a college kid and he went into the Army and through Fort Snelling to go to basic training. He became a military officer, infantry officer in both Europe, until that was done, a decorated officer, and then was in Japan till the end of 1946. That was 4 years. So he went as a private and came back as a 22-year-old infantry captain, and I was a war baby. So I don't remember seeing him coming back, but I'm sure glad he did. But it's part of my heritage about Fort Snelling, and I've been in Minnesota for over 42 years. I immigrated to Minnesota without any papers in the 70s, and so I've now been acclimated, but we love to take our grandkids and my kids to Fort Snelling all the years, and it's a pleasure to support them. I do have the official pin. I don't know if you've got it, but we had a great day yesterday talking to all you legislators about all of our bills, that our initiatives, and the last one on this is the Fort Snelling capital investment funding. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. I will take just a few minutes if anyone from the public wishes to comment. Seeing no one, we will then proceed to the presentation about Glenn Sheen Mansion. Introduce yourself, please.
Yeah. Well, first off, thank you, Chairman Erdahl and members of the House Capital Investment Committee. My name is Dan Hartman. I'm the director of the Glenn Sheen Mansion in Duluth, Minnesota, which is a part of the University of Minnesota. I apologize for this intro slide, but it's my first way of saying thank you for allowing me to be here today. This is an honor in many ways, but also it's a nice way of making sure I got that language right at the beginning. So, well, with that being said, this is kind of our mantra at Glenn Sheen, is really to make sure people are wowed when you come. This is not your average experience. And so with that, we start with this kind of beautiful slide of Glenn Sheen in the spring. But this is also kind of a nice reminder that this request is part of the University of Minnesota's overall request. And you can see Glenn Sheen's request at $4 million in this total of their larger request. But today, I'm really not going to spend time talking about the rest of the University of Minnesota, because that would not really be great for anybody. So I'm going to first talk about the Glenn Sheen Capital Renewal. Once again, this is a $4 million request with a $4 million match. And to kind of give you a heads up of why this is important, I want to kind of give you a brief history of Glenn Sheen as best I can. And you've probably heard about this, but Glenn Sheen's in the middle of, a pretty awesome turnaround. And I'm happy to be a part of that. But we've taken Glenn Sheen from a low of around 61,000 visitors a few years ago to the last fiscal year was 129,000 visitors. And I'll tell you, this last calendar year was 141,000 visitors. So to put that in perspective, that is nearly double the attendance of the James J. Hill House, of the Fort Snelling Project, of many other historic properties in Minnesota. And so it has quickly become one of the iconic historic icons of our state. And I'm probably most proud of that this last year, we had 141,000, we actually beat the 1981 year, which, love or hate it, was the year of popularity of the murder. And you had the murder on TV all the time. We never thought we'd beat that year. And so for us to beat that was a significant achievement for us at Glenn Sheen. And that really shows that Glenn Sheen is, I'll get to this later, but more than a murder. I'm happy to say we are now officially the number one visited house museum in the Midwest. We actually beat out Chicago's Dree House last year, which is a point of pride for us. But to kind of highlight this too, this isn't just us floating numbers. This is actual revenue growth. And so this is the last couple fiscal years, and you can see directly connected to our tour revenue, it's gone up a considerable amount. And that's because we've added a lot of new tours, some at higher price levels, But we really got Glenshee on a much better operational lens. So now Glenshee operationally year to year is self-sustaining. We have a lot of this capital debt that's why I'm here today, but from a year to year, we pay for all of our staff salaries out of ticket sales, which is a rare thing in the museum world. But once again, we are more than murder now. And I make this point because for a lot of people who know Glenshee, who are stakeholders in the community, this is what they know of it as. And it's always a surprise for people, but really murder customers are not good customers for us because they generally don't come back. And so you'll realize that a lot of our best customers, no pun intended there.
Really bad.
But really today, everyone comes for what we call the big and beautiful. They want to see this 39-room mansion on the shore of Lake Superior. And the more we've marketed that, the more we've really started to ramp up Glenshee's attendance. And so besides it being successful, why does it matter? Why do people want to come to this? It's really because of that history. And a lot of it goes back to Chester and Clara Condon, who built Glenshee. And Chester Condon is instrumental in the original development of the Mesabi Iron Range. And so it's a better, larger regional story. And so when you hear of the Mesabi, you don't really typically hear of his name. And frankly, when we talk about the Iron Range history, it's typically 1920 on. But there's a great, really huge fight that took place between 1890 and 1900 where you have names like Rockefeller, you have names like Carnegie, you have names like J.P. Morgan. All three of these men collided at the Iron Range in Duluth and or in our region. And if it wasn't, Chester Condon's in the middle of all of that story. And so really this is that great national story that takes place here in Minnesota that we tell that at Glenshee. But in addition to this is the early 1900s. There are just crazy things going on within the labor community, and we tell that story really well in addition. We just started a new servants tour where we talk about the different social movements that are taking place, but we also talk about the people who actually physically built Glenshee. Like, this is a list of the day-to-day contractors actually building Glenshee. I found this one recently of in the middle. It says John Hartman or possibly John Hortman. I'm trying to figure out if this is actually a relation to me, which would be really kind of funny. But there is just a great history there. Here's some of our early staff. Actually, these are some of the gardeners and some of the maids working inside the house. And so a lot of them are immigrants coming from across the country, and they're really excited to have this job where you get three meals a day, and the family's gone half the year, and so you have this beautiful property on the shore of Lake Superior. And so there's this whole other great history to the labor side of Glenshee that really just starting to expand on. And then the last little history thing, because I don't want to get too much into that for you, is the North Shore. Chester's major causes at the end of his life is he wanted to develop this drive that went up the shore because he felt like here's all these beautiful things to see, and unless you have a boat, there's no way you're going to be able to see things like Gooseberry Falls, and he wanted to get people up that. And so he made this very public commitment, actually while he was a House of Representatives, to make this drive. He made a bill so that the city of Duluth could annex land outside of itself to start that 14-mile stretch. He makes a public commitment for up to $1 million to actually pay for the road. That's Chester Condon. And so that's part of that early legacy. But honestly, today, what I really love about Glenshee and what I think makes Glenshee different than a lot of other house museums is the students. The vast majority of the staff at Glenshee are UMD students. And the students themselves have now decided to have a student service fee so that they actually get free access to Glenshee year-round. Last year, we had 1,300 students actually tour Glenshee on their own on a guided tour. That is far more than any other U of M museum. And that's because they actually have a legitimate interest in Glenshee. And actually, the student body president of UMD is actually in the audience, and he doesn't know I'm going to call him out, but there he is. But also, we have 120 students actually on our payroll. And so these are jobs from tour guides to actually gardeners. I mean, there's a wide variety of what these students do at Glenshee, and it's a unique learning environment you typically don't have. Now, the last thing I really kind of want to end on, and this is mostly new data I'm kind of excited to talk about, is the economic impact of Glenshee. And fairly recently this fall, we actually did a pretty thorough impact statement from Rockport Analytics. This is the same group who was hired to do the data on the Super Bowl. And so it was kind of fun to see some actual numbers to what is the economic support for Glenshee. And I'm proud to say that overall our economic impact is about $7.5 million a year. We actually contribute about $2.5 million, or we help generate $2.5 million in federal, state, and local taxes. To the state of Minnesota itself, around $697,000 every year comes from actual taxes generated out of Glenshee. And one of the other big surprises for people is where people come from who visit Glenshee. And that is all over the state of Minnesota. The lion's share of our traffic is the Twin Cities metro area. But otherwise, honestly, about 5 to 10% of our visitor traffic comes from the Duluth area. It's almost entirely the rest of the state. For example, in Rochester has almost nearly doubled the attendance of the city of Duluth. And so I make this point as strong as I can that Glen Sheen, as much as I love Duluth, is not really a Duluth asset. It's a state of Minnesota asset. Clearly, as you can tell by the visitation, and I would say the larger general historic story of it. But why I'm here is we have some definite barriers coming forward in our future success. And many of you in this room have seen it, but we need some very critical repairs need to get fixed soon. So our formal garden wall could not be more of a bricks and mortar project. But this thing is falling down. At any time, in any next heavy snowstorm, whatever weird winter condition we get, that southern formal garden wall could easily collapse. And I beg of you that this is something we need to do soon before the whole thing falls and it becomes an embarrassment to our state. If you've ever had a wedding in Glen Sheen, our default location is the winter garden room, which if it rains, it actually leaks water directly down into the room below it. I won't publicly say that a whole lot on TV, but that's the case. But that's where our weddings are. But the other really kind of scary ordeal is the out-of-date utilities. We use a boiler that is nearly 100 years, well, it's over 100 years old. Most of the electrical throughout the entire mansion is 100 years old. And a lot of our emergency systems, frankly, need to get updated as well. And a lot of that is in the absolute critical phase. And the one that's more public, and I think the one that people like to talk about a lot, is the pier. Our pier broke off in the late 1960s, and ever since then, we've had a lot of our storms that have just battered that boathouse. And so as much as I'd love to fix the boathouse, my actual priority is that pier, because once we get that pier in that L shape, it'll actually help protect that boathouse and allow us to go look for private money to repair the boathouse. But if we don't, we'll lose that boathouse soon to the wave action. This fall was a little scary moment. We actually broke off the front door in one of our storms, and we have a significant amount of damage across the shoreline from one storm. And so I'm telling you, we need to build this pier soon before it's too late. And I also want to point out, it's become a great new place at Glen Sheen. We have a different way of viewing Glen Sheen now. We view it as more of a community space, more as a space to celebrate things. And so this is our concert on the pier series. And this is the band Four on the Floor out of Minneapolis. And we actually had 1,900 people show up for this show. And I love that people came by paddleboard, they came by kayak, they came by sailboat. And it's just a nice way to experience Lake Superior, great Minnesota music, but also Glen Sheen in the backdrop. Now, look at this picture and imagine that pier going 30 feet further out and then 100 feet to the right. And that's the original pier. That's what's supposed to be there. And so then when you have those 100-foot waves, it would look a little bit better than this. And so I'm here to help repair these pieces so that we can continue to have these great successes and the state of Minnesota really can kind of come to enjoy it. And so here's my more normal end thank you slide. But thank you for having me here again today.
Thank you, members. Representative Hausman, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I was listening carefully, it sounds like that $8 million total project cost will not do the boathouse.
Correct. This last spring, summer and fall, there was a pretty bigger dig into the cost, and frankly, it's been a couple years since the last time we've done this, since 2 years ago, and so we've decided to make a little bit better deal on the pier, and the pier is going to be about $4 million versus the original estimate of around $2 million. And once again, the priority is that pier over the boathouse, and as much as I'd love to get that boathouse done, we need to get these other projects done soon. And I'm mindful of the amount of money that exists in the world, and so I think me coming here asking for an endless amount of money wouldn't be reasonable.
You're mindful that there's limited money in the world? what a noble idea. Okay, Representative Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to announce to the committee and the folks in the audience that we just happen to be having Duluth and St. Louis County Days downtown today at the Intercontinental, and Director Hartman, are you going to be selling any of those cool pins down there to try to raise money for Glen Sheen?
Please come grab a pin, and actually we'll have some soft bricks for you, too. So
I'm wearing my bulldog today.
Nice.
Good job. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, the question I have maybe as a follow-up to your comment. The request is for $8 million, and you're going to raise $4 million through non-state funding. And what is the status of that fundraising, and what is the source? Is that fees that you collect from all the visitors that you were telling us about when you surpassed Chicago? Or is it donations from people that are willing to support the mansion.
So I'm going to deflect this conversation to Regent McMillan, who is the chair of the Board of Regents.
And might I add that when this request was made in previous years, I think both when I was the chair and with Representative Hausman, there was a concern that in their list of priorities, the University of Minnesota never included Glensheen. And, through last summer and in various visits there, had conversations with Regent McMillan and with others, the county, the city, Glensheen, and explained to them that there may be a willingness of this committee to fund a portion of the project, but we had to have some commitment from the University of Minnesota. And Regent McMillan, would you add to that, please?
Certainly, and I'll begin by introducing myself, Dave McMillan. I live in Duluth, so it's a great day to be here, Duluth and St. Louis County days, and it's a pleasure to be here before the committee. And I think I'm not sure I can describe exactly where Director Hartman is going to go work on those funds, but the conversation that we had had was the opportunity to demonstrate to private house museum foundations other private funding sources would be greatly benefited by a demonstration of support from the state. And if the state's willing to engage in what I might call a matching opportunity like this, that's going to be a signal of support from the public sector that he will go take and try to double down in the private sector. I don't know who all the donors might be. Mr. Director Hartman can probably help you with that, but that was the idea. And it's a creative, I think, unique solution that from the Board of Regents perspective. I can recount a little bit of how we got there without taking up too much of your time. Obviously, the Board of Regents, like yourself, represents lots of differing opinions, some who felt that this resource probably best belongs somewhere else, perhaps the Historical Society, some who feel on the opposite end of the spectrum that it is a core part of our mission. And the board ultimately landed at what we think is a good middle ground, which is it's a very unique asset. It does support our outreach mission very, very critically. I think it's one of the best outreach things we have in Duluth to demonstrate to the rest of the state that we do have a University of Minnesota resource that isn't up on the hill at UND. I think it also supports our education mission. You saw some of the statistics that Director Hartman gave you about student participation. It supports our research mission. There's bee experiments there. There's cold weather gardens there. There's those sorts of things. And, again, I'll go back to outreach. It really supports that. So, overall, the board believes there is a nexus to our mission. And ultimately, I think it was a 10-1 or 11-1 or 10-2 vote, but a substantial majority of the board landed on the half-half split with a private funding match to go with it, representing the unique nature of the asset. We don't have anything else like this in the university system, quite like this, and that's how we got there.
Yeah. Mr. Carlson, a very quick one. My question was the status of the fundraising for the $4 million, and I think from your comments, you haven't started yet.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, that was the gist of my question, what the status was. And you're going to go to donors then as opposed to admission fees? Well, that was the other part of my question.
Yep, at $4 million, that's going to be...
Mr. Hartman.
Excuse me. Representative Carlson, this would be entirely mostly a private giving and probably some foundation help if possible. But honestly, I think with the timeline involved, it's probably more on the private giving side. We'll never make enough money off tour revenue to pay for that in a given year. Thank you.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just if you can, in a tight, brief fashion, I know you haven't done probably full engineering out to the future, but you probably have a pretty good sense of, are you on the way up the hill, or are you cresting the hill and about to work your way down into better condition for the whole facility?
I would say, Representative Stock, I would definitely say we have turned a corner. I think the best thing about Glensheen honestly happened about 15 years ago when they repaired the roof. The roof being repaired was a significant step forward for the overall mansion itself. And I noticed in this conversation that really we're not talking about the mansion at all in these repairs. We're really focused on almost these exterior parts of the property. And for us in the House Museum world, that's a very big step forward. Mm-hmm. And I wish that was true of all House Museums, frankly, because that's the bigger hurdle is the mansion itself. With that being said, we've done about $6 million in repair through insurance and flood damage over the last 5 years. And so there's been some significant work that's taken place at Glen Sheenan in recent times. And I joke to people that if you were there 10 years ago, it looks a different place today.
Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about the pier, and I notice on your sheet it says the pier if money allows. So are you anticipating that the cost of the pier sort of reconstruction is going to far exceed the total $8 million, or are you just unsure at this time?
Mr. Hartman.
Representative Dean, this goes back to kind of the what private giving amount we would be able to reach at, and we know that the current amount for the pier, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mr. Swanson, who's in the audience, I think it's around $4.9 million, and so it's a pretty significant cost involved in that. And as we've learned from other past construction of the past, some things turn out differently in actual reality than in cost estimate.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, generally they're not less. So given that, what is the current sort of medium-term thinking about what to do with the pier in the short term to sort of, secure the state it's in, and then what's the plan as far as funding in the future to actually get that rebuilt to its, original configuration?
Mr. Hartman?
Representative Dean, at this point we've been doing a little bit of what I would call fix-up stuff in the meantime to get the wave action a little bit further away from the boathouse itself. There's not a great deal we can do to help preserve the pier, but the storm this fall really did destroy the front of the boathouse, and so we had to remake that whole temporary wall again. And the other unfortunate thing is we lost a lot of our beach rock immediately in front of the boathouse, and so that's also made the waves closer to it. And so one of the conversations we have is if funding mechanisms don't work out is placing more beach rock in front just to give it another temporary barrier, because we are, frankly, just worried about the structure in general. It's one of the last remaining structural boathouses on all of Lake Superior. And so, I mean, time is of the essence, and sometimes you got to do the little makeshift things you can to make it survive.
Thank you. Any other questions? Members? Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And might I add that even though may I add that even as we highlighted Glen Sheen today, that doesn't mean that the other University of Minnesota projects are put in the rearview mirror somewhere. Pillsbury Hall, the Dairy Science Building, the HEPA projects, all of those things are still certainly will be given due consideration. Our next presentation today will be by Second Harvest Heartland on their 2018 capital budget request. And I believe we have a Dario Anselmo, Representative Anselmo, is leading the group.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Begin your presentation, please.
All right. Thank you.
By telling us who you are.
I will do it, Mr. Chair. My name is Dario Anselmo. I'm the state representative from Edina. I would like to thank you and the committee for having us here today to present this bill for a hearing. I'll also start with an apology. As a freshman, I'm supposed to bring treats to new committees I've not been to. This is the one committee that I've not brought food, but it will be forthcoming because I'm here with some people from General Mills.
Wait a second now. You're here to talk to us about food.
I know.
And you don't bring any.
It's been a long day. I recall the last time that I made food here in the state office building, it did not end well.
This is your guy.
So we'll go ahead. Well, I'm here to present bill number 3495, and it's for an important subject for me and for so many people, involving the second Harvest food shelf and the legislative approval looking for bonding for $18 million to build a new facility in the city of Brooklyn Park. I think many people are familiar with that organization. I'm going to have some people talking about that and going through it in detail. For me, what moved me is the fact that 1 out of 10 Minnesotans suffer food insecurity, and 1 out of 6 children do not have enough food to eat. This is pervasive in cities, suburbs, and greater Minnesota. And I'm deeply concerned, and I'm hoping that we can find a way to get a bonding request for this. When I looked at the organization, besides the breadth and their history and all that they've done, it was also interesting to note that a number of people that were constituents in my communities, it's great to see leaders at all level in the community helping out and chipping in. With that, I'm going to introduce a longtime friend of mine that I just realized was on the board a couple months ago. We've known each other for about 25 years. I think when I met him, he was literally sticking the toys in General Mills cereal boxes. And now he's got a real big deal job. I can't say what it is, but I will let him introduce himself. Mr. Chair.
All right. Good afternoon, and thank you for your time. My name is Sean O'Grady, and I head the convenience and food service business at General Mills. I also sit on the board of directors here for Second Harvest Heartland, and I sit on the board of directors of the National Body of Feeding America based out of Chicago. At General Mills, we take our mission of serving the world by making food that people love very seriously, and we take our commitment to helping those who can least afford to buy food just as seriously, and that's why I'm here to talk to you today. For many years, General Mills has worked hand-in-hand with Second Harvest Heartland to achieve their mission of ending hunger through community partnerships. Our partnership includes sharing our expertise, donating food that is distributed across the state, and serving on the organization's board of directors. We value this partnership because Second Harvest Heartland plays a vital role in General Mills being a good steward in the state of Minnesota. Our history is that we were a founding member of Second Harvest Heartland almost 40 years ago. As Dario mentioned, 1 in 10 Minnesotans does not have enough food to eat, and 1 in 6 of our children goes hungry. And we know that hunger is costing our state nearly $1 billion a year in lost workplace productivity, poor educational achievement, and health care costs. Hungry children are more likely to perform poorly at school and suffer from anxiety and depression. And these are not just our future workers here in Minnesota. They are the classmates and friends of our very own kids. General Mills has and will continue to step up to address the alarming impact that hunger is having on our communities, and we hope that you will step up too. We can all do something about this, and we can do it right now. On behalf of myself, General Mills, and our leadership, I'm here to express our unwavering support for the Second Harvest Heartland bonding request. This investment will have a significant statewide impact that will provide more food to those who need it and positively impact our state's economic competitiveness for years to come. With that, I just want to thank you for your time and for your consideration of the bonding request. Thank you.
Thank you. Next presenter, please.
Hi, I'm Dr. David Silstra. I am president of Central Care Clinic, and that's based in St. Cloud, Minnesota. We serve a good portion of the patients in central Minnesota. In our region, we have about 30,000 patients who have a hunger problem, and many of those have a chronic disease as well, and especially diabetes and congestive heart failure are among those. What we see is that people with congestive heart failure and diabetes can get into trouble fairly quickly, and there is an overlap of people with a hunger problem ending up being admitted to a hospital toward the end of their paycheck period, and that there are some substantial issues going on there. So we partnered with Second Harvest to try to intervene with that for this group of patients, and had a program we called Food RX, where we provided food provided by Second Harvest to patients with food insecurity and congestive heart failure or diabetes. And we saw some great results, and it was a 25% decrease in admissions among that group of people and about an 18% decrease in number of ER visits. And so that really made an impact on our patients in their health care, and we consider that a major win for our organization, for our patients in our region. And for that reason, we are enthusiastically supporting Second Harvest in their bonding bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
My name is Sue Esty, and I am the executive director for Second Harvest North Central Food Bank based in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and I represent one of the five other Feeding America food banks that serve Minnesota. Our mission is to engage the community to end hunger, and we serve about 115 hunger relief agencies in Aiken, Cass, Crow Wing, Itasca, Kuching, Kennebec or Kennebec, and Mille Lacs counties. Hunger is pervasive in northern Minnesota, but it's under the radar for most people. Yet we see many of the people who are our neighbors. They're seniors struggling on fixed incomes, working families, lots of people who are relying on the food that we provide them because they're struggling to make ends meet. 1 in 10 Minnesotans does not have enough food to eat, but in the rural areas of Minnesota, it's worse. Hunger affects 1 in 8 Minnesotans in my area. Second Harvest North Central Food Bank provides an average of more than 3.6 million meals every year. We help over 17,000 people in our service area every month. Thousands of children rely on us for food because 1 in 5 children in North Central Minnesota is food insecure. We simply couldn't do the work we do without a strong partner in Second Harvest Heartland. Second Harvest Heartland serves as the hub of Minnesota's hunger relief system. They work with 1,000 food shelves in the state and the other Feeding America food banks to ensure that we have enough food to reach our hungry neighbors. We count on Second Harvest Heartland for more than 75% of the food that we distribute in North Central Minnesota. So the barriers that they're facing with their current facility impact us directly. We at Second Harvest North Central Food Bank enthusiastically support Second Harvest Heartland's bonding request to further expand its important work to end hunger in Minnesota. This is an investment that will reach every single community in the state, including my community of Grand Rapids. I hope that you will fund this critical funding. Hungry Minnesotans and those of us who serve them are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Erdahl, members of the committee, my name is Jay Strobel, and I'm the city manager of Brooklyn Park. We are the official applicant for the general obligation bonding that will be invested in this statewide food distribution facility, and we are thrilled about our partnership with Second Harvest Heartland. Brooklyn Park has a population of just over 80,000 Minnesotans. We're a very diverse community that is home to a number of Fortune 500 companies, manufacturers, healthcare innovators, and now one of the most innovative social service nonprofit organizations of the state. Hunger is an issue that affects our community. We know that over 10% of our residents live below the federal poverty line. The food provided by Second Harvest Heartland to our local food shelf, SEEP, is also essential to our community. The city of Brooklyn Park is excited to be home of the Second Harvest Heartland for another reason. In addition to the current Second Harvest Heartland, employees will be living, working, and spending their hard-earned dollars at our gas stations, restaurants, and retailers. This project will lead to 100 new jobs being created in the region directly from this new facility. On top of that, we'll follow the economic activity of tens of thousands of Second Harvest Heartland volunteers who will travel to this facility to donate their time to help pack food for hungry Minnesotans. This facility will have a huge economic impact on our community and the surrounding communities in the northwestern metropolitan region. On behalf of the City of Brooklyn Park, I am here today to express our community's enthusiastic support for Second Harvest Heartland's bonding request. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rob Zeske. I'm the CEO of Second Harvest Heartland. Thanks so much to the committee today for the time. Thank you very much to Representative Anselmo. As you've heard today, we present what we hope is a winning project with enormous benefit for our entire state. We touch every county in Minnesota with our healthy food, and we come shovel-ready with a nearly 2-to-1 match in hand and ready to apply the cash, the food, the volunteer time, and goodwill of our community to our community and to the 532,000 Minnesotans that we directly serve. This $18 million investment will generate over $140 million of private support every year that will impact every one of our communities. We have spent 30 years in our current building, growing from 1 million pounds distributed in roughly 1987 to we're on pace for 100 million pounds this year, and we've never asked for bonding or facility support from the state of any kind. We've eked out efficiencies and capacity over decades, as you and our community would expect us to do, but we've simply reached our limits. This is a project for all of us to be proud of, supporting healthy food access through dynamic and efficient nonprofit system in every one of your districts provides a vital service to the state. But you're also investing in a winning organization, if I do say so myself, that exemplifies, we hope, what a private-public nonprofit partnership ought to look like in Minnesota, leveraging crucial public investment with the backing of private industry and the savvy of private industry to move toward a Minnesota where no one goes hungry. In this project, there is a role for everyone, for volunteers of time, even for the recipients of the food that we distribute who want to say thank you, for food manufacturers, for growers, for financial donors, for grocers, for students engaged in service learning, for faith-based groups who volunteer and operate local food shelves and meal programs. And there is a role for the state. For a $140 million organization that runs on an average individual donation of $47, we need your help. And right now, for the once-in-a-generation investment. Second Harvest Heartland, for this investment and our work, does not collect rent, tuition, admission fees, or tickets. In return for this support, we will engage our community in service, increase the amount of healthy foods available to our low-income neighbors, offset health care costs, and help children thrive in school so that hunger doesn't hold back Minnesotans anymore. This project can't wait. Some private donors to our campaign have made their funding contingent upon bonding this year, believing that they expect the state to contribute its share. But even more important to me, right now we have children in Miss Vicky's kindergarten classroom just blocks away from this building that are falling behind in school because they show up hungry. In her words, some of my kids right here are in survival mode. In St. Cloud at Centra Care Clinics, as Dr. Tilstra testified, patients screen for hunger more than twice as often as other social needs and cost us more in visits to the emergency room, in insulin, in prenatal care, because they don't have the right kinds of foods, straining our healthcare system. And this summer and fall, Minnesota growers will plow under literally hundreds of millions of pounds of edible crops in this state because they can't find a market for those crops, and we are not currently in a position to take advantage of those offers. We will pay for each of these conditions until we invest enough to address the issue, and today's investment in our facility is a crucial step. Hunger is Minnesota's largest solvable problem, and we're asking you to help us take one critical step in our efforts to solve it. We won't let you down. With that, I'm happy to take any questions from the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, any questions of anyone with Second Harvest? I guess, Representative Anselmo, you've done a tremendous job.
You know what, I'm lucky to be in the community, Mr. Chair, lucky to be in the state that we are, and just happy that we can find a way to help and plug in to have, you know, C-level suite executives helping people that face, you know, sometimes homelessness and certainly hunger is a distinctive honor. I appreciate that. I'll conclude my comments with whatever recommendations we can get for bonding, and let everyone get off to Duluth days. Besides being from, representing Edina, I actually am from Duluth, so I'm going to go there and join Representative Eklund and some other people. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Selma. Just maybe I have a quick question or two. Mr. Ziska, how many donors contribute in a year?
Last year we had 87,000 individual financial gifts, and that doesn't include gifts from the in-kind food nor the more than 40,000 volunteers who contributed time.
Okay, thank you. And I was wondering, Mr. O'Grady, does General Mills have burritos?
Just to be clear, I am not responsible for
Oh. All right, well, thank you.
That's pleading the fifth.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You put an open door out there and nobody walked through it. So in the loss of food in the state that gets plowed under, using your phraseology, your inability to use is a space problem? Is that what I infer from your statement?
Mrs. Eske.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely true. We have access to food that has been offered to us. Our facility was never designed for perishable foods, nor for an amount of food that we have this side. So in addition to the additional physical space that we have, an important component of our future volunteer, our future home, is our volunteerism, where we have as we've described, literally hundreds of thousands of hours of time from volunteers across the state who help us repack Minnesota potatoes, Minnesota sweet corn, and 28 last year, 28 different varieties of Minnesota-grown crops that we can get to our neighbors.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the packet. And I've heard your presentations and good work. I just want to tell you thank you for including each of these in our packets, and they're kind of honed to each of our districts, which I thought was pretty powerful. So my district, for example, close to a million people have missed meals. And so that's just, you know, missing a meal per year. I mean, that's amazing how many people. So take a peek at that if you haven't. It's pretty powerful. Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just sorry that you're here asking us for this money. I wish we weren't dealing with the issues of hunger and people going without food. But thanks for the work you are doing. You know, Representative Lilly talks about the million meals missing in his district. Mine's more than two times that. So really appreciate your work.
Thank you. Any other questions, members, comments? Representative Hausman.
If you invite a comment, you know I always have one. We just hearing this story and the power of that and three really wonderful projects today, I just came from a meeting in which the transportation sector is asking for $200 million of general obligation bonding for local roads and bridges, $200 million for local roads and bridges, and they talk about the backlog. And I realize, Mr. Chair, the challenge you have, you have probably an $800 million number you've been given, I'm guessing. You take 200 off the top for $200 million for local roads and bridges, you have $600 million left for everything else, for higher education, for wastewater infrastructure, for every state agency, from military affairs.
Stop right there, you're already past $800 million.
I have. You are right. And I just am looking around the table. I can see everybody's project as I'm looking around the table. I mean, I just think we have to be so very careful about moving that in that direction where we have not gone before, because it does affect all of these other worthy stories that we're hearing.
All right, thank you. I guess that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
If members have no other business, we meet again tomorrow. But as for today, well, King, this case is closed.